draw you out a little more on the critical issue of nuclear weapons and nuclear disarmament. You very eloquently described the appalling malignant aching black hole that we're in with both the failure of the NPT review conference and the failure of the summit to deliver absolutely anything. I hope you might agree that an architecture that will bring together the concerns of non-proliferation and disarmament is needed, and that may take best take the form of the Nuclear Weapons Convention. There are some very encouraging examples of the Ottawa landmines process that non-government organisations with some sympathetic governments and eventually achieved significant success in a relatively short few years, and also of major developments internationally having been achieved despite the opposition of some major countries. One thinks, for example, the International Criminal Court, despite opposition from the US. I wonder how you would see prospects for advancing disarmament, and particularly the role that non-government organisations and potentially a few critical sympathetic governments might be able to play to break this absolute morass that we seem to be in.
Well, the first critical need, I think, is to bring disarmament, arms control, non-proliferation issues. And they are interrelated, absolutely, and I agree totally with what you said about the necessity to... Everyone wants to talk in government about non-proliferation, get very excited about North Korea and Iran and so on, but they don't want to talk about disarmament. But the truth of the matter is the two things do go together, and if you do want support from most of the rest of the world on these issues, and the nuclear weapons have not, you've got to be prepared to accept that principle. So I think the important role for NGOs is to just bring the issues back to centre stage. The only time we've heard about WMD in recent times has been in the context of hunting the snark in Iraq, but also the problem with terrorists and potential use of missile, fissile material and access to non-state actors. But there's a very real danger, as the high-level panel put it, of a cascade of proliferation breaking out again. I mean, the NPT regime is incredibly fragile at the moment. There's a whole bunch of countries that, are just ripe and ready for breakout. And once that sort of that sense of constraint gets lost, which has held us all together for the last 30 years, and with India and Pakistan going the way they did, it's very close to the edge at the moment. So there really is a necessity to bring this stuff back on the agenda and to get people seriously focusing on it. I think there's a particularly serious necessity in Britain, for example, to get Britain to play some kind of leadership role. I mean, this absurd pretense of the importance of retaining a nuclear weapons stockpile country like Britain, similarly France, it just it's just not credible, and a little bit of leadership from there would be hugely important. I don't want to, however, overstate how much can be achieved by NGO campaigns. There's a kind of orgy of self-congratulation goes on all the time about the landmines thing, and that really was great to get that sort of convention up, and the momentum there for something that was incredibly difficult to get any movement on at all, and the NGOs are responsible for that. But when you look at the actual, getting sign up, getting commitment by some of the key players, that's still wholly lacking. There's a hell of a long way to go in the in getting the the Landmines Convention being genuinely universal and genuinely enforced. And so at the end of the day, I mean, NGOs run their heads into the wall of government resistance. But the biggest resistance of all is the US. And if there was any, on the nuclear stuff in particular, and if there was any kind of willingness at all on the US side to even just make some very basic concessions about, acknowledging the, in principle, legitimacy or the necessity for long-term elimination, and to make some serious steps towards doing that, to absolutely commit itself to the non-development of bunker busters or any new category of weapons, to absolutely commit itself to going back and back and back to the Senate on the CTBT issue, to commit itself absolutely to a fissile material cutoff treaty. We've got more goddamn fissile material floating around the universe than anyone could possibly need at the moment for any purpose. And that's one of the things about which there's a lot of consensus in the policy community to do that. But you can't get the Americans to first base. And without that, it's very difficult with all the campaigning in the world to actually move the thing forward. So my hope remains basically that we will get a new articulate snappy agenda of issues with the Blix Commission report, and that we can sort of mobilise, you know, a consciousness-raising exercise and start to put the pressure back on the key governments. But it's a tough one. It's a really, really tough one to get movement on. Sorry, what's the problem? Oh, you're getting neglected upstairs. Yeah, I think that's good. Someone else.
You can tell me to ask a question, okay?
Well, I think the issue of impunity and immunity is really quite critical, and I'm hugely sort of active in support of my organisation is of the ICC. I think gradually we're winning that argument. One of the things that hasn't had much attention is that even the Americans have very significantly muted and moderated their position on that. When the report of that Darfur Commission for Sudan came out 6 months ago and went to the Security Council and trying to use the Security Council route to authorise a prosecution of the worst offenders in Darfur, the US abstained, you know, from voting, didn't use the veto. And that's something that wouldn't have happened in the previous, you know, 3-4 years in the previous administration. So, and Condi Rice, to give her credit for that, I think, you know, played an extremely important role in ensuring that that was the US response. I mean, it would have been totally indefensible for them to have vetoed it. I'm not suggesting there's any, you know, real, genuine, you know, anything that they could have done anything else in decency, but the fact that they did is an important step forward. I think rather than using this extremely erratic device of national courts applying, you know, sort of international humanitarian law and grabbing people within the jurisdiction and plonking them before, you know, some domestic tribunal, it's such a blunt and erratic instrument, and it's sort of so difficult to make it actually work in any but the most extreme cases where there's some territorial or jurisdictional connection. I think the best thing is to just concentrate full bore on making the International Criminal Court a really serious, credible institution. And I think the momentum is developing for that. At the moment, it's got about three areas in its docket. One is Darfur, the other is the Ituri situation in the eastern Congo, the massacres that occurred there, and the third thing it's focusing on at the moment is the Lord's Revolutionary Army in northern Uganda. Which is, you know, catastrophic human rights violation situation. In all of those situations, there were warrants actually sort of pending and process pending. And the court's been quite sort of measured in gearing itself up to deal with this. But I think it's absolutely credible that we allow it to sort of establish credibility in 2 or 3, you know, teething exercises of this kind, and then go full bore in terms of public campaigning to get more and more stuff referred to it. And I think that's the way forward.
No, at the back.
No, sorry, everyone.
Well, it's going to have to be a really whiz-bang question.
Loudly, please.